From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
It is now time that we look into the whole 14 years of the war on terror in Afghanistan and beyond with a critical analysis, with finding truths, and with finding those who are behind backing to extremists, wherever they may be, in this region or beyond.
That was the former president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, commenting on the U.S. military operations in his country over the past 14 years, as part of what Washington has termed the War on Terror. Speaking with RT's Sophie Shevardnadze on the 14th anniversary of what was then called Operation Enduring Freedom, the former president added this.
I have been from the very beginning against aerial bombardment of my country, and I have said repeatedly, and I will repeat myself again, that the war on terror is not in Afghan villages, it is not in Afghan cities, it is not in Afghanistan, that if we want to succeed against terrorism, we must go to the sanctuaries, we must go to the training grounds, we must go to those who finance them and support them. Unless we stop that, we are only causing harm to civilians in Afghanistan. Therefore, it is for this reason that I did not sign the bilateral security agreement with America, because this could not be explained to me in a manner that would satisfy me.
5 months after the U.S. began its war in Afghanistan in October of 2001, it turned to Iraq. Despite the 1991 U.S.-led war against Iraq and a decade of crippling sanctions and regular bombing raids by the U.S., the country remained a relatively peaceful place, in stark contrast to the war-ravaged territory that's now a hotbed of terrorism. After the U.S. leveled Libya in 2011 and transformed that peaceful and prosperous nation into a smoldering wasteland that, like Iraq, is also now a hotbed of terrorism, Syria took center stage. Although it's been 4.5 years since U.S. and Saudi-backed terrorist groups began their proxy effort to topple Syria's government, vetoes by the Russian Federation and China on several occasions denied the U.S. the no-fly zone resolution that Washington used as cover for its Libyan bombing campaign, and the government in Syria remains in power. Although the U.S. decided a year ago that it would conduct airstrikes inside Syria anyway, ostensibly not against the government, but against the ISIS terrorist group, ISIS has continued its fight, which has been directed at the same government that Washington seeks to topple. In the past weeks, Russia's decision to intervene, upon the invitation of the legitimate UN-recognized government in Damascus, has drawn an angry response from Washington, which now seeks to blame Russia's involvement for all of the problems within and emanating from the region. For more on this, we spoke with our correspondent, Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international relations at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow, Thursday. In 2 weeks, apparently Russia has done more damage to ISIS than the United States and its 60 allies have done in more than a year.
Yeah, so that is, of course, an estimate that's come out. The Syrian government has said that as of a few days ago already, that up to 40% of ISIS's infrastructure, at least in Syria, has been destroyed. I think that that's a little premature. I do believe that Russia has done more serious damage to ISIS already. And we can take a look at that, just the nature of the strikes. You know, the U.S. has recorded some, has says it has committed some 2,000-some strikes. But we know from insider, comments off the record that printed in the Western mainstream press, New York Times, that only 20% of those actually involved weapons release. And on the list of targets included things like excavators, which I take it to mean bulldozers.
Right.
So you take a look at the nature. By far, the majority of the strikes against ISIS that the U.S. have done have taken place in Iraq. Now, of course, U.S. strikes in Syria technically are illegal. They're a violation of Syrian airspace when they are evidently refusing to cooperate or coordinate those strikes with the legitimate U.N.-recognized government of Syria sitting in Damascus. Even that aside, their strikes in Syria appear to be minimalistic and designed more as managing ISIS. And this is premise is, even in Iraq, is clearly revealed by the fact that the Iraqi government says that the U.S.'s strikes have been inefficient, was the words they use, and they have been openly welcoming Russian presence. They haven't made an official request for help for Russian airstrikes in Iraqi airspace as of yet, but there's a lot of talk about that, you know, from all the parties involved at the highest level. And Iraq has this coordination center that it has set up to share intelligence with Russia, Iran, we can presume Hezbollah is sitting on that, and the Syrian government. Which is making the U.S. furious. And further further on that, Iraq clearly gave Russia permission to fire cruise missiles from the Caspian over its territory at targets in Syria. So all of this leads us to that Iraq has serious doubts about what the U.S. is doing. You know, and this only reinforces the conclusion that the U.S. has, for the last year and a half, only been managing ISIS, pruning it where it wanted, letting it grow completely unrestricted, such as in Palmyra, where it was pressing deep into Syrian government territory. So it kind of exposes the game that the U.S. has been playing here in attempting to use ISIS as a tool for regime change, and only really seriously thinking about it then. Even afterwards, the talk from American foreign policy officials has been that in partition of Syria, they believe is inevitable, that they don't believe that they could ever completely defeat the Islamic State. You know, they talk about degrading it, containing it. They don't, simply because it has too much popular support from disaffected Sunni populations on both sides of the border. And it's not to say it's supported 100% by people on its territory, but it has evolved in a power vacuum where, at least to some extent, it was welcomed by a large enough percentage of the population there who feel that their interests, both in Iraq and Syria, as Sunnis and most likely rural, religiously conservative Sunnis, were neglected. So I think the hope generally on all sides is that they can damage ISIS enough, cause enough damage to it that it will internally collapse, and something will come out of that, some descendant statelet, if you will, that can be dealt with. But on either side, I don't think that ISIS can be completely defeated either by the Russian-led coalition or by the U.S.-led air coalition, such that ISIS will cease to exist completely. And this also serves U.S. purposes, because one of the main geopolitical purposes of the U.S. By attempting to overthrow the Syrian government has to reduce this arc of Shia influence that they built by removing Saddam Hussein from power in a disastrously failed operation, you know, more than a decade earlier. A Sunni statelet stuck in between Syria and Iraq, hostile to both, you know, a rump government of perhaps of Alawite and other minorities on Syria's west coast, and a Iranian-leaning Baghdad government on the other side, a Sunni statelet presumably propped up by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, as well as the U.S. and Turkey, would suit their purposes just fine. And in the end, that may be what we're stuck with. It's hard to see. It's really hard to see that the political forces behind ISIS on the ground could ever be completely defeated, even with the Syrian army, the Iraqi army, and very large numbers of Iranian and Hezbollah troops involved. So we're really, whatever the outcome, we are looking at a major geopolitical transformation of the region, where the Sykes-Picot lines have become erased.
You know, it's interesting looking at all of it, really. If you go back to the time before March of 2003, you know, you go back to the 80s, for example, you had a government in Iraq that was willing to go to war with the with the Shia government in Iran,
mm-hmm.
on behalf, more or less, of the United States. And if you think of it in terms of assets, territory, and such, now in Iraq, you know, a Baghdad-Tehran alliance with a small Sunni statelet in between, it's quite a retreat from that position over the past 30 years. After all of the expenditures in weaponry, manpower, political capital, etc. Is this a trend that's going to continue to follow, or do you think that the toehold in this little statelet, should that come to pass, might be enough to suit U.S. purposes?
Well, I mean, like any country, a major great power, at least, the U.S. plays a multi-vector foreign policy where it has maximalist and minimalist goals, and those don't always seem to be completely clear. I think this idea of a Sunni statelet wedged in between is a minimalist goal. We have to remember that I think it's two major geopolitical reasons why the U.S. has become so obsessed with regime change in Syria. We'll call it three. The first one is to reduce this arc of Shia influence stretching from Tehran through Syria and Lebanon. The second one is as a prerequisite to targeting the Iranian government for regime change itself. Its Syrian ally would have to be dealt with. The third one would be the geopolitics of pipelines and wanting to put pipelines from the Gulf despots through Syria and Turkey and into Europe as a way of reducing Russian political energy influence on Europe via pipelines that are required for to keep Europe running. All of those have necessitated for the U.S. regime change in Syria to a government much more friendly to their interests. A Sunni statelet wedged in between certainly doesn't meet the last standards for the pipelines and only marginally meets the standards for the first two. But if we take a look at this, the entire, if we premise that a big part of this has been reducing the Shia arc of influence, the shark of influence was created by the U.S. removing Saddam Hussein from power. And they are acting now, doubling down with regime change in Syria to try to correct that. The irony appears to be that what they've actually done is solidified that alliance, cemented it in a real, operative, on-the-ground, military way that was never existing before. This is a real-time military intelligence organization cooperation in Baghdad, and added them a great power patron with Russia now overseeing the whole thing. This is a disaster for U.S. foreign policy, a disaster of monumental proportions that has undergone in the last two presidential administrations from Bush to Obama. And it is all due to U.S. meddling in one form or another of an extremely illegal way under international relations of regime change. And they don't seem to have learned any lessons from this in Washington. The criticism of Obama is not that he shouldn't have interfered, but that he didn't interfere enough.
Yeah.
that he should have just gone all broke for overt military regime change in the first place, like, you know, more like they did in Libya, in Iraq the first time. And they haven't learned any lessons from Libya or Iraq the first time. They still think that they can impose order out of the chaos that is created by the removing of these authoritarian leaders. People love to say, oh, Assad is a dictator killing his own people. Well, first of all, a little bit of context. The area is riven by deep-seated ethno-religious tensions. Strong men, such as Assad, in the best cases, have been what has protected Syria's and other, you know, even Saddam Hussein, you know, protected these ethno-religious minorities. And the biggest end result of, you know, the Arab Spring and continued interference, one of the biggest results is the wiping out of Orthodox Christianity throughout the region, which has held there since the Byzantine Empire. And it's sad to say to many Western liberals, but they have to face facts that democracy, especially transplanted democracy, you know, Western style on a foreign situation, is not an ultimate good. In many ways, it's an ultimate evil, and that's what we're looking at here.
You know, as far as it goes with the U.S. somehow riding influence on the back of a Sunni statelet, if that's what comes to pass there, there is the example of history in Iraq where the Sunni minority held power, essentially brought to power by the United States, and betrayed. Well, first, after Saddam Hussein acted again willingly as an agent of the United States after being more or less installed and armed and funded for many years, the betrayal in 1990 and 1991, the continued torture of the Iraqi people by the United States, including the Sunni leadership, throughout the 90s, and then, you know, the war that decimated the country. If I were heading this statelet, I'd be a little bit concerned about looking to the United States for patronage in that context. Do you think there's going to be a problem for the U.S. that way?
Whatever role the U.S. plays, in a lot of ways, we're talking this theoretical Sunni statelet wedged between Iraq and Syria here. That would emerge as some kind of descendant state after ISIS is degraded. It will probably play a back role to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is really stepping up, and to some extent Qatar as well. Saudi Arabia is really stepping up in their role as regional hegemon as a result of tens of billions of dollars of arms that the U.S. and the U.K. have sold them. Very quietly, unnoticed by many, is that Saudi has been one of the largest, in many cases, the fourth largest military spender over many of the last years in the world. And they have built up quite a little U.S. and U.K.-bought military arsenal there, trained by U.S. and U.K. military personnel. And the U.S., you know, recognizing that its heyday of global hegemon in a unipolar way is over, is quite happy to farm out the role of hegemon to Saudi Arabia, which, at least being Muslim and Arab, is able to act freely militarily in the region in a way that Israel never has without being provoking some kind of, you know, complete total war across the region. So the U.S. has been building up Saudi Arabia's role, I believe, and is happy to see them step in. And I think Saudi Arabia would play a bigger role in this. But, you know, as with the Saudi weapons supply, you know, everything, Saudi Arabia is really, shall we say, a fist puppet for U.S. foreign policy interests in the region. I mean, of course, Saudi Arabia and U.S. policy can differ. They're not automatically the same, but increasingly Saudi Arabia does act in that capacity, and they would be the ones to step up to this role, and they would certainly never back down to it because, for them, they see Iran as an existential enemy, and they have come to see Syria, in the continuation of a Ba'athist government in Syria in the same way. So even if the U.S. steps down, Saudi Arabia is stepping up, and I think most of our listeners will probably agree that it's hard to find a more nefarious, more evil, in the big E sense of the word, government in the entire world than the Saudi despotism.
Oh, yeah, it's on its own axis.
Yes.
And there's an interesting contradiction there, too. Saudi Arabia itself, the regime, is in turmoil. The war on Yemen, with all of that military might, is not going very well. And you also have all of the machinations in the back room that are going on there.
Yeah, and I'm sure we're only seeing, the tip of the iceberg here. There's lots of rumors going around in the Arab press and on, shall we say, second-rate internet sources. I don't want to name any names, but that there is turmoil. That perhaps the Saudi king is hospitalized, perhaps with psychological reasons. Perhaps this is all some kind of internal palace coup. It's not clear exactly what is going on in Saudi Arabia within the royal family, but things do not appear to be sanguine. Something is going on there.
Let's see. Just one last thing.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll go back to where we started. The Russian attacks, well, first of all, Russian airstrikes in that region, it's the first time that you've had Russian or Soviet pilots in the regions, I think since the 1950s, really, in Egypt, right? Weren't they flying then?
I would say in the 1970s there was some Russian direct action during late 60s, early 70s, during the Syrian Egyptian disagreements, conflicts with Israel. The Soviet Union was active then. But it's certainly a major foray into the region when everyone was saying, has been saying for a long time now, that Russia lacked the power of power projection. And I think everyone is a little astonished at the comments, military comments coming out of the brass in the Pentagon have been that they were very surprised at the very efficient way Russia put together a fairly significant amount of power projection in such a short amount of time, most importantly, without U.S. intelligence detecting that it was being prepared and done until it was already too late to do anything about it. And that's a major problem for the United States. They've been wrong-footed in Georgia. They were wrong-footed in the Crimea. They've been wrong-footed by Russia now. They seem to not have very good intelligence and to be unable to detect Russia's military moves. Certainly Russia does still have a much more limited geopolitical horizon to act in than the Soviet Union did. Russia is not a global military actor, but I think Syria is the very limit of its reach. I don't think that it has designs or the capability to act much further. But they've certainly shown that they can punch above their weight in Syria, and it's taken everyone from the Pentagon to the White House by surprise. Russia, doesn't want to do this. This is expensive for them. This is at a time, when they're already suffering to some extent, although not as much as depicted in the Western press, under sanctions. You know, their budget is surviving, but, you know, it's showing some strain. They don't want to be engaged in this expensive operation. It is simply a line in the sand saying it is time to go back to the United Nations, to the rule of international law, because everything that Russia is doing in Syria is within the bounds of international law, whereas everything the U.S. and its allies is doing in Syria, from the backing of, quote, rebels, unquote, to the violations of Syrian airspace, is against international law. Russia doesn't want to interfere in the Middle East. There's a whole potential list of backlashes and problems that result from such interference. It would prefer to remain focused on the near abroad, on the former Soviet states. But they've reached a point where, this presents a national security threat to them. It is close enough to the Caucasus. An ISIS state is something that they, or any kind of post-Damascus jihadist state in the region is something they simply can't tolerate. It's a national security threat to them, a direct national security threat in the case of ISIS, which has already claimed territory in the North Caucasus, as part of Russia, as its own, you know, theoretical territory to religiously govern. We've already seen the emergence of franchised jihadists in the North Caucasus operating under the ISIS brand name, that have sworn allegiance to them. They haven't had any significant success so far, thanks to Russia's, resurgent intelligence services, but they will, they only have to succeed once, and they will someday. An ISIS state, in northern Syria, 24-hour drive from the Caucasus in southern Russia, is something they cannot allow. No great power capable of resisting it would allow it. The U.S. wouldn't allow it. And Russia felt it had to act in this space. And they're really hoping that perhaps, it's unlikely, but that perhaps with a change in presidency, the U.S. might come to its geopolitical senses.
You know, you mentioned that Russia doesn't have quite the international footprint that the Soviet Union had.
Absolutely.
That's in terms of being able to project military power. On the other
hand, also soft power as well. There is no, communist international.
Right. However, there is an entirely different basis for much larger international influence, at least in terms of potential, and that's in the economic sphere. I'm speaking specifically of the BRICS. Before you had, perhaps Cuba and some influence in Nicaragua before for the Soviet Union. You now have Brazil. And Brazil linked into a, more and more integrated Latin American region, starting at the Mexican border.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. In particularly in economics realms, the U.S. attempt and claims of isolating Russia with its sanctions and so on have just proven that Russia is a fully integrated and integral part of the global economy. Not only that, but in recent years, Russia has built up a very strong political as well as economic alliance with the BRICS, with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that means that it cannot and will not be isolated, no matter how much the West yells and screams and stamps its foot like a little child. They have to sit down and recognize that Russia has interests and compromise on those, and that those interests are legitimate. I see the key linchpin there being China. In the Cold War, Nixon managed, whatever else we may think of him, managed this brilliant foreign policy goal of formalizing the diplomatic split between a communist Soviet Union and a communist People's Republic of China. That has gone the exact opposite, and Russia and China have a very real strategic alliance that is bordering on becoming a real, shall we say, special relationship here. I don't see that the U.S., and it has been driven there, both of them, particularly Russia, which would have rather, even the current Russian elite would have rather embraced Europe. But instead, they find themselves in a position of embracing China. And in some ways, we should all thank the Obama administration for that.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.